in Mr. Barnes's commentary, he quotes from some persons who had been to that country and states the evidence that they give of this. He says, thus Volney says, and I don't know who Volney is, from the reports of the Arabs of Baker and the inhabitants of Gaza, who frequently go to Man and Karak on the road of the pilgrims, there are to the southeast of the lake of the Dead Sea, within 3 days' journey, upwards of 30 ruined towns absolutely deserted. Several of them have large edifices with columns that may have belonged to the ancient temples or at least to Greek churches. The Arabs sometimes make use of them to fold cattle in, but in general avoid them on account of the enormous scorpions with which they swarm. That's from Volney's Travels, Volume 2, pages 344 through 346. And so Mr. Barnes says it is remarkable that an infidel, as Volney was, should in this, as in numerous other instances, have given a minute confirmation of the ancient prophecies. And he quotes some others here that I will not read. But he again says, Burkhart had determined to attempt to pass the same way as being the shortest route to Jerusalem, but he was repeatedly told that it was impossible, and the difficulty of the journey is illustrated in the travels of Captains Irby and Mangles. They offered 500 piastres to an Arab tribe if they would conduct them to Wadi Musa, but nothing would induce them to consent. They said they would not go if we would give them 5,000 piastres, observing that money was of no use to a man if he lost his life. So strikingly has this prediction been fulfilled. So he just simply attempting to show that he made a prophecy that none should pass through it forever and ever. And so those who had traveled to that country saw that it was utter desolation. Nobody lived there, and people were very reluctant even to pass through there, those who were natives of the area. But the cormorant, and the bittern shall possess it. Now, a cormorant is some kind of a bird like a pelican, and a bittern is also a bird of that nature. It's a little difficult to know exactly which animals he's talking about here, because even the scholars do not totally agree on this. And the owl also, and the raven shall dwell in it, and he shall stretch out upon it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. So this place was going to be a habitation for these wild birds, for these animals that could live in a desolate area and not be bothered by man. And when he says he shall stretch out upon it the line of confusion, this is kind of like the line that somebody would lay out in building a building, maybe like the line that a bricklayer would lay down before he lays his first course of brick, and the stones of emptiness. So the things built here, he described as confusion and emptiness. So you build a house out of stones of emptiness, and what do you have? You don't have a house, because there is nothing there. They shall call the nobles thereof to the kingdom, but none shall be there, and all her princes shall be nothing. Now you know, we read in our introduction that there was a time when this land had princes that ruled it. And they were called princes. But here he says, they'll call the nobles, but none shall be there, and all her princes shall be nothing. There won't be any rulers, no power. And the thorn shall come up in her palaces, nettles and brambles in the fortresses thereof, and it shall be an habitation of dragons and a court for owls. So the palaces that they had, the edifices, the fortresses, would be a place for thorns and brambles and nettles, and owls would be there. And he says dragons, and the word dragon probably means jackals. There are many things that dragon could mean, but it's some kind of a wild beast, and it's probably jackals. And thinking about this prediction about Idumea, I'd like to read another little paragraph from Mr. Barnes's commentary. He says, he's quoting from a man named Stevens. I would, says Stevens, when standing amidst the ruins of Petra, the capital of Idumea, and with this passage of Isaiah in his eye, I would that the skeptic could stand as I did among the ruins of this city among the rocks, and there open the sacred book and read the words of the inspired penman written when this desolate place was one of the greatest cities in the world. I see the scoff arrested, his cheek pale, his lip quivering, and his heart quaking with fear as the ancient city cries out to him in a voice loud and powerful as one risen from the dead. Though he would not believe Moses and the prophets, he believes the handwriting of God himself in the desolation and eternal ruin around him. And this is from a book called Incidents of Travels in Egypt, Volumes 2, page 76. So there have been time after time people have gone back to this country of Idumea and read these prophecies and seen the literal fulfillment of them, written at a time when this very city of Petra was one of the greatest cities in the world. It goes on in verse 14, "The wild beasts of the desert shall also meet with the wild beasts of the island, and the satyr," and I believe that word means goats, "shall cry to his fellow. The screech owl also shall rest there and find for herself a place of rest." Just showing the wild beasts are going to inhabit it. "There shall the great owl make her nest, and lay and hatch, and gather under her shadow. There shall the vultures also be gathered, every one with her mate." Just showing that these wild animals, these uncivilized creatures, would be the result of the total destruction of this country that God had many, many times prophesied the desolation and the destruction of. So in verse 16, he begins to conclude by saying, "Seek ye out of the book of the Lord and read." Now, seek ye out of the book of the Lord and read. What's he talking about here? He's talking about something that he calls the book of the Lord, which would have to be the Scriptures. The Scriptures were in a written form. They were in an available form to God's people. And here he commands and requests that they seek out of the book of the Lord and read. Now in Daniel 9 and 2, we have some evidence given that there was such a thing known as the book of the Lord that they did read from. Daniel 9 and 2. "In the first year of the reign of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the Lord, word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem." So Daniel simply says, "I understand from the books of the Lord, the books of the word of Jeremiah, that it was going to be 70 years." Again in John 5:39. Now here we have a writing that's before the New Testament was written, before the New Testament was available. "Search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and they are they which testify of me." Now that's Jesus telling somebody to search the Scriptures. God's Word was written and available. Again we have in John 7 and 42, "Hath not the Scripture said that Christ cometh of the seed of David and out of the town of Bethlehem where David was?" I'll just read this Scripture to show that when he says, "Seek ye out of the book of the Lord and read," he's talking about the Scriptures of the Lord that were well known and well documented and well referred to. What were they to read? "No one of these shall fail, none shall want her mate, for my mouth that hath commanded, and his spirit it hath gathered them." Now all of these prophecies about the destruction of Idumea, Obadiah, Amos, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, others, all of these prophecies, he says, "Seek ye out of the book of the Lord and read." Read about it. And then he says, "No one of these shall fail." None of these prophecies are going to fail. "None shall want her mate." That is, no prophecy is going to go unmated with its fulfillment. "None shall want her mate, for my mouth it hath commanded, and his spirit it hath gathered them." That is, my mouth commanded it to happen, and the spirit has gathered them. It's going to happen. And he hath cast the lot for them, and his hand hath divided it unto them by line. Now that's as though the Lord had laid this land out. He'd cast lot. Many times land was distributed by drawing lots for your portion. He'd cast the lot, and whatever portion each part was going to get, the lot had been cast. It had been laid out and divided unto them by line. They shall possess it forever, from generation to generation shall they dwell therein. Speaking of the fulfillment of these prophecies and the fulfillment of the fact that these wild beasts would be the prime inhabitants of the land. So that's a very stirring and definite prophecy that he gives there about the destruction of Idumea. Well, let's go on into the 35th chapter. We may not have time to get through it all, but we'll try. We have about 20 minutes left. This chapter, as we said, this chapter has to do with the foretelling of the joys of God's people after they were delivered. And it is talking primarily about the return from Babylon, number one, and secondarily about the coming of the Messiah, number two. That's the lesser and the greater fulfillment of this prophecy. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. Now, the wilderness and the solitary place. We all know what really this is talking about. A wilderness is an area that is desolate. It is hard to inhabit. It's a place that's easy to get lost in. It's a place that is dangerous to be in, where very little that will sustain life is made available. And the average place and the solitary place is like a desert. Well, when you look at the world that does not know God, that does not follow the commands and the desires of God, you're really looking at a wilderness and a solitary place. It is a place that is devoid of spiritual blessings. It is a place that is barren of the knowledge of God. It is a place that is dangerous for one to try to inhabit it. It is a place that is not considered to be civilized and truly inhabitable. Well, he says that the desert shall rejoice and the blossom as the rose, and the solitary place and the wilderness shall be glad for them. So when the coming of the Lord happens, these desolate areas are going to be made to blossom. They're going to be made to rejoice. They're going to be made to be glad for them, because they're going to be changed. Verse 2, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. Now this place that was known as the solitary place is going to blossom abundantly, showing that all those who have before been in this state of solitary desolation and wilderness, all of them may blossom. They may rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. So he takes the excellency of Carmel, which was a fruitful, productive area, and he takes the glory of Lebanon, which was noted for its giant cedar trees, and he says they're going to be given to this land that was a solitary place, that was a wilderness. They're going to be given to it. So the wilderness is going to be transformed into a place that has all the glory of Lebanon and that has the excellency of Carmel. And they shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. Now, beginning in verse 3, he's still talking about a great change here, this barren land that's now been made fruitful. But he's also talking about now God's people making the journey. Originally, it was the journey from Babylon to Jerusalem. That was the original journey. Now, ultimately, it is the journey that we travel as we go down the path that the Lord describes as narrow is the way that leadeth unto life. That's the journey that we're now traveling. So he says to those who are in this way and who are in the journey, Strengthen ye the weak hands, and confirm the feeble knees. Now, of course, for a person to be able to travel and to be mobile, they need their hands and their arms, and they need their knees. Those are essential things to being able to travel and be mobile and to be a worker. So he says to strengthen the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. If you're weak in the knees and weak in the hands, you're not going to be very good to do any kind of physical work or to do physical travel. But these things are to be strengthened. In Hebrews 12 and 12, the writer there borrows from this very same prophecy. He quotes from it. And there he says, "Wherein lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed." Now, as God's people travel along this way, it is possible for one to become lame and not to be able to travel, and consequently be turned out of the way, be taken off of the path, and lose their course. And rather than let that happen, he says to strengthen the weak hands and to confirm the feeble knees. That is, build these people up, give them the strength, give them the encouragement so that they'll not be lame and not be turned out of the way. And as we think of someone who is weak and lame, I'd like to read another passage here from a man who had been a traveler in the desert. Campbell's Travels in Africa is where this comes from. He says, "Lameness and dumbness are the uniform effect of long walking in a desert. The sand and gravel produce the former and fatigue the latter. In such cases, some of us have walked hours together without uttering a sentence, and all walked as if crippled from the sand and gravel getting into the shoes. But the sight of water, especially if unexpected, unloosed every tongue and gave agility to every limb. Men, oxen, goats, sheep, and dogs ran with speed and expression of joy to the refreshing element." Now, that's just the description he gives of being in a desert and how it brings about the lameness and the dumbness, but then whenever the refreshment comes, how that the lameness is healed. And whether that's really a true figure here or not, I don't know. "Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you." So the people, as they travel on this journey, before they get to Zion, they're still traveling, they're told to be strong and to fear not, because your Lord will come with a vengeance, even God with a recompense. He's going to protect you. He's going to save you. He will come and save you. "Then when the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert." Now, verses 5 and 6, the description he gives here are really, truly the works of the Messiah. They are the works that Jesus did while he was here. "Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped." In Matthew 11 and 5, here is Jesus now speaking of his works, beginning with the 4th verse. And he's talking to the disciples of John, who said, "Art thou he that should come, or do we look for another?" Jesus answered and said unto them, "Go and show John again those things which you do hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached unto them. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me." So Jesus says almost exactly what Isaiah says. The blind, eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, the lame man shall leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. In Acts 14, verses 8 through 10, we have an example of a lame man during this time being made to walk. "And there sat a certain man at Lystra, impotent in his feet, being a cripple from his mother's womb, who never had walked. The same heard Paul speak, who steadfastly beholding him and perceiving that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, Stand upright on thy feet. and he leaped and walked. So that's a very definitely a fulfillment of that. Again, in Matthew 9, 32 and 33. As they went out, behold, they brought to him a dumb man possessed with the devil. And when the devil was cast out, the dumb spake, and the multitudes marveled, saying, it was never so seen in Israel. So here's an example of a lame man jumping up like a hart, he says. Here's an example of a dumb man speaking, and they said, we'd never seen this happen before in Israel. There are examples of the blind being able to see, the deaf being able to hear, and so on. And Isaiah said this would happen. Now let's read it again. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. Now this world is like a wilderness. It's like a desert without water. But when the Messiah comes, when the Messiah brings them the good news of the kingdom, whenever the availability of God's kingdom is made to them, then, he says, in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. Just like a wilderness having suddenly becoming filled with water and the deserts having plenty of streams. And you go out here in many of the places in this country where there's deserts, Arizona, New Mexico, and West Texas, and you get water to that land and it is fruitful, fertile, productive land. And so it is with any nation or any group or any individual in the world. No matter what a wilderness or what a desert or what a solitary, desolate place his soul might be, his mind, his spirit can be so far removed from God, you get the living waters there and it will blossom forth abundantly. It'll sing forth the praises and it'll be then, of course, fruitful ground. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons, where each lay, shall be grass with reeds and rushes. Now this word parched ground really means the shining sands. And it is thought by many of the scholars to mean that it's the mirages. As you travel, and I can read many paragraphs that Mr. Barnes has written about mirages, as you travel in the desert country, you can look out certain times and see what appears to be shining, glistening water. It's really described as the shining sands, but it looks just like water is there, although it's not water at all, it's the dry sands. And as the sun rays hit that a certain way, and as the vapors from the sand begin to evaporate, it makes this shiny, shimmering look as though it was reflection of water. And they tell of caravans who'd headed towards those mirages. And of course, as you go get closer to it, it gets stays the same distance away from you, so you never get to it. But the people in the back of the caravan could look, and it looked like the lead camels were walking off into the water. It looked like they were getting up to their bellies in water by those in the back, while in the lead they were still looking yet ahead to it. It's a mirage. It looks like there's something there, but it's not. And so this is a very beautiful image. The parched ground shall become a pool. In this life, everything that we go at without God is just like a mirage. It's like we're going to beautiful stream of water or lake or even an ocean. But really, it's just a parched ground when we get there. And all we ever get out of it is continue looking ahead, trying to see, trying to find something better and something suitable. It's as though the world, you know, is in constant pursuit of happiness and constant pursuit of peace, and they never, ever find it. Well, these, to the Christian, to the person who is following God, these mirages, then, this parched ground becomes a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. So it actually is a pool. It actually is a spring, and it's not, it's no longer just a mirage or just a false vision. In the habitation of dragons, where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes. Now in this this place where the dragons inhabit, these dragons, of course, we said were jackals. why it would become a place with reeds and rushes, that is, it would be abundant with growth and vegetation. Now in verse 8, and an highway shall be there, and a way. Now a highway is a place that's built up on a, like on a turnpike or a thoroughfare, and a way is a more general way. It's a little hard for me to reconcile these two, a highway and a way. Some of the translations, such as the American translation, does not have and a way. A highway shall be there and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those. The wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. Now this highway is not going to be a place for unclean. This is going to be the way in which the Lord's people will be traveling. No unclean will be there. The wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err therein. Those who travel on it are going to be known as the wayfaring men. They're going to be travelers. We today as Christians are travelers. We don't have any permanent place now. But we'll not err as long as we're on this highway. As long as we're traveling the right way, we shall not err. Even though the world looks upon us as fools, though fools, we shall not err. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go thereon. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. Now, the way he depicts this highway, it's traveling through a desert area. It's traveling through a place of desolation and wilderness. It's traveling through a place where there are lions and ravenous beasts. But as long as we stay on the highway, even though we're in dangerous ground, even though to veer to the right or to the left, to get off of the path just for a moment would put us in jeopardy of a ravenous beast or of a lion or being lost in the desert or being starved to death of thirst. As long as we're on the highway, there's no beast going to be there, no ravenous beast, no lion. There'll be no desolation there. There'll be no mirage. It'll be like a spring there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return. Now this word ransomed here is very closely connected to the word redeemed in verse 9, and it means something for which a price has been paid. In the case of the Israelites, Idumea was one of the sacrifices. Babylon was one of the sacrifices that God required as payment to redeem them. But in the case of us, the Lord's Son was the sacrifice. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They're going to come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their head. There'll be a people that are rejoicing, a people that have a purpose, a people who know what they're doing and why they are and where they're going. They'll not be lost. They'll not be in these paths of the desolate sands and wandering about aimlessly as vast wasteland, but there'll be people on the highway of the Lord. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So we have a very beautiful description here of God's people, the people who are walking on this highway. Although the land all about is desolate and wilderness and the wild beasts are there, they are safe and secure in the path that the Lord has laid for them. They're on the highway. They're on the way that the Lord has designated for them to walk. And as long as they're there, they shall not err. The world looks upon them as fools, but they'll not err. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And that truly is a very apt and perfect description of God's people today. We're on the road to heaven. We're not there, but we're on the road to there. And God already realizes that we're coming. He's prepared a way for us. And as long as we're on that way, we're still traveling, we're still journeying, but we will not err if we stay on the way. So we're going to conclude there with the end of that 35th chapter. And truly that is a beautiful little chapter. It has some very great images in it. And we had to rush a little bit to get through it tonight, but I hope that we were able to bring out some of the salient features of it. Anybody have any questions or comments? Well, next time, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 36th chapter. And in that chapter, we're going to go back now to the siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib, and we're going to see it from a little different angle from what we've seen it before, but the next four chapters are dealing in that area. Then in the 40th chapter, we get into a little different area of Isaiah, what many of the scholars call the second half of Isaiah.